What does it take to make workshops work? And how can we facilitate collaboration that sticks and leads to results? My name is Miriam Happness, and with the Workshops Work podcast, I'm on the mission to find the magic ingredients that make workshops work. Today with me on the show is Leighan Rogers, and we speak everything teams, team building workshops, team coaching, how we deal with toxic participants and non-functioning teams and how we can build sustainable trust. So stay tuned. And by the way, if you don't have pen and paper at hand to take your own notes, scroll down to the show notes to download my free one-page summary. Now, enjoy. Hello, Leighan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Great to have you here to speak about teams and facilitating teams.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I always start with the same question. When did you start calling yourself a facilitator? And actually, do you?
I do call myself a facilitator. It's interesting because I'm starting to lean more into calling myself a coach again. I started calling myself a facilitator probably around 15 years ago when I started doing a little bit of work with a company called Leadership Strategies. And I went through their training on facilitation and then started teaching their facilitation course. And prior to that, I had always called myself a trainer or a coach. Mm. And then after that, even if I'm doing training, I would call myself a facilitative trainer, a facilitrainer. Like it's a blend of the two. So probably 15 years ago.
Oh, wow. I'm curious about the switch that you have called yourself differently over the years. Do you think that there's more understanding nowadays in the value of facilitation? Hence, you can use this term more than maybe 10 years ago?
That's a good question. I feel like I have a little bit of a bias because I'm in the world of facilitation. And so a lot of my friends and colleagues and people I'm with use that terminology. And one of the reasons I'm starting to think about, instead of saying I do team building facilitation, but I do team building coaching, is I do think it's a word that it's an industry word that we know what it means. I don't necessarily think that other people always know what it means. Mm. It's kind of our little lingo, I think. But coach people tends to be more universal.
Yeah. Although I do see a big difference.
I do too. They are different. You're absolutely right. There are big differences.
And actually the team building part of facilitation and coaching is very interesting because it is right on the edge between the two. So for you, where would you say that coaching ends and facilitation begins, especially in your work when you work on team building?
It's a great question. So the simplest way I think of it is if someone says, hey, we're doing an offsite and we want you to come in and do some work with the team, regardless of what the work is, it's kind of a one-off come and do it for a session. That to me is more facilitation. That feels like facilitation. If though it's a team and I'm going to work with them continually over the year or longer, even that feels more like coaching because there may be other things or one-on-one conversations or assessments or other things that are happening in and around those team meetings. And it's a longer relationship and I would have a different lens on it.
And it almost sounds as if over the longer period and working on the team, it's really working inside of what might not work. So doing the inner work of how they communicate with each other, how they function together, whereas facilitation is rather looking maybe on the outside, the activities.
Well, yes. And I mean, even if it was a one day or a 2 day facilitated session, we could be talking about how do they work together? How do they communicate? We could go there. It's just that if that's it and they only engage me for a 1 or 2 day session, we're going to get so far. And then unless they engage me again or they continue to do that work on their own, you know, I don't have a part in it. However, if there's a team that says, hey, let's get, you know, I'm continually meeting with them over time, you know, it's a deeper, longer relationship. We can do that more.
Yeah. And do you think as a specialist in team building, is it even possible to build a team in a day? Because we always hear about team building days.
Yeah. So I think to me, team building is like trust, right? It's you don't do it and check the box. It's an ongoing, never-ending process, and it's important. So can we have a team building session in a day? Yes. Do we build a team in a day? No, we build a team every single day for the rest of the lives of the people on the team, if that makes sense.
It's like a relationship, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So we can get started and we can have some actionable things to do and get clarity and begin building relationships and all of that. And it needs to be continued well after that day, every single day.
Yeah. What do most people get wrong about team building? Because it sounds like a shiny object. Almost every, even beginner facilitators, I would say that hosting a team building workshop is a low-hanging fruit. Everyone can start with that. May I poke you a bit?
Yeah, yeah. So I think for me, the words team building, they have different connotations. Different people think of different things. And so many people go straight to, oh, you're talking about trust falls or playing silly games, or, you know, they go to that side of the team building. And to me, what team building can be, I mean, certainly there can be those fun moments. Let's get to know each other. Let's have some fun in the process. And let's really do some work on the team. Like, what's working? What's not working? How are we dealing with conflict? Are we holding each other accountable? All that stuff, which can be actually very, you know, much more challenging. I know a lot of facilitators will say to me, I don't like that. That's just too emotional. Or they would rather do like strategic planning, where it's very like logical and breaks down, versus get into emotions where you have team members who are, you know, unhappy with each other, aren't working well together, and it can get emotional. So I guess to me, like, team building, I think we all think of, when we hear team building, we have a wide variety of what it means to us. And to me, it does mean deeper work on the team. But I have to be careful, because if I say team building, other people who might have the connotation that we're talking about trust falls and, you know, doing a community service project together.
And then again, if I hear the deeper work and on the emotions and getting to know each other, and I heard you using the word trust a couple of times, where does it start and where does it end? Is it, when does it become group therapy? And when is it still team building? And when do you know that it's done?
So, I mean, great question. I think every team is so different, Miriam, right? Every team is so different. What they want and what they need, how much time we have to do whatever work it is, how open they are. Are they already kind of working well together and need to take it to the next level, or are they really struggling? So I don't think there's a single answer. To me, this is what makes the work so fun and interesting, is every single team. There are common challenges and issues in every team. I mean, they're just common, universal things. And yet every team is so unique and different that I don't think there's like a one size fits all of what to do or when to do it or how long it will take. I think it depends on each team.
Yeah. Can you give an example of these things that every team has? I think we might hear some sides in the audience.
Yeah. I think some of the most common challenges that I see consistently are, one of them is around alignment. And so the team being out of align, either about their goals, their roles and responsibilities, or their methods and the ways that they work. Almost always, there's at least some confusion about roles and responsibilities, if not outright disagreement. Like, I think you're supposed to do it, you think I'm supposed to do it, or worse, we both think we're supposed to do it and we're competing, right? But there's, alignment is a huge area for teams. And even if a team gets in align, they don't stay in alignment very long, because something will change. Something will change and they will need to realign. So that's a huge one. And then I think another example of one that's really common now, especially with hybrid and remote work, is the feeling of connection. You know, I just did a blog this week about loneliness in the workplace, and people just don't feel connected. Or maybe the only time they're connecting is in a Zoom call and it's work related, and they don't really feel a sense of connection or bonding with the team. And so those are just two examples. I could go on and on.
Yeah. Interesting examples. And the second one made me just think of, and then the team leaders wonder about silent quitting.
Quiet quitting, yeah.
Of course there's silent quitting if the weekly Zoom call is the only way of connecting to team members and engaging with them. And then everyone remains silent because the team leader didn't take some facilitation course.
There you go, yeah.
And when I hear connection and I hear alignment, it seems as, what do you think comes first? So when you work with a new team, would you say, okay, it's first about the connection to get to know each other and to have this bond, and then it's easier to speak about alignment? Or is it, oh, let's speak about the work issues first, and so that will build some connection and bonding?
Yeah, I lean to most of the time it's the personal connection first, and then it makes everything else easier. Mm. Because if we know each other and start to know who's in the room and what makes them tick and what they're about as human beings, not just your Miriam Hadness, but your Miriam Hadness, and then I know more about you and vice versa, we're going to probably have increased trust and ability to want to work together because you're now a human being that I know. So I typically would lean into the getting to know exercises earlier, and then that sets the door to be able to go in and do deeper work. Like, for example, Miriam, a common thing, if I had a day with a team, a common thing I might do is in the morning do something like a DISC workshop, where it's not about DISC, it's about let's learn about each other. What makes you tick? What do you want and need? You know, what are your preferences? And they're really learning about each other in a way that they may never talked about before.
Yeah. And just to clarify for the some who might not, DISC is the personality test with the four colors, right?
Yes. A communication styles instrument. Yes. And there's a lot of versions of it with the four colors. Right. Exactly. So to me, like, that's a great way, in a very meaningful way as well, to get to know people, not just, you know, what do you like to eat, but like, that's meaningful. And it breaks the ice about differences. And then that gets you ready for later in the day to do some deeper work on the team. So whatever you're doing, maybe you're doing some role alignment or you're talking about our goals. Now we've kind of broken the ice. We know each other more personally. We're more warmed up and ready to have deeper or more difficult conversations about the team, especially if we may have different points of view. It feels safer now, and we have some tools to use to be able to have those help in a healthy way.
Totally. And you also created a common language between the team members, that, and maybe even some moments of laugh. Oh, yeah. Now I can clearly see why you're a red type who's always heading at the goal first and full speed. And then,
yes, yeah. Exactly. Exactly. It's like, once you know that, it's like, oh, you're the type of person who wants to get it done and get it done fast. And when you're pressing me to make a decision, you're not trying to like put pressure on me or make me feel uncomfortable. It's just, you have the need and the desire to make decisions quickly. Yeah. And so it depersonalizes sometimes that when there's tension between people, oftentimes, almost always, there's at least some element I find of different styles. And when you understand, oh, that's the reason that she's asking me a million questions about what I'm doing. She's not challenging me or doubting me. She just likes to have a lot of context, a lot of information. So she feels like she's in the know. And so when we start to have these little awarenesses of what people need and why they need them, it can soften the tension and make it so much easier to work together.
Yeah, this is such a good example, because very often there are these frictions in a team and they build and grow until something breaks. And usually it's never bad intention, but just different ways of communicating. And I assume that someone would call you in to start a coaching process or workshops on team building when something is actually already broken.
So it's one of two things. It's either something's broken, help, we don't know what to do, come fix it. Or it's the opposite. It's like, hey, we're having our annual offsite and we want someone to come in and work with us. So I get both types of calls. Yeah.
The reason why I ask is, I can imagine that when a team comes newly together and everyone is curious about each other, then all you can create the foundations for a winning team. But when something is already broken, how do you get them back into the state of curiosity where they're even open to look at someone's personality type and develop the empathy for, oh, maybe it wasn't about me. Maybe it's just the way they communicate.
Yeah, I love the question about curiosity, because that's really important, isn't it? That people don't lock into their viewpoints, that they're open and curious and willing. Well, just to go back to DISC as one example, to me, it is kind of fun. Like you mentioned, laughing, and DISC can be fun the way that I typically do it. I mean, you can laugh about it and kind of have some fun with it, and you're learning and sharing and allowing people to share I typically do it in a way that I allow people to share, here's what I want or need. Here's what motivates me or demotivates me. So it's like, let me tell the team what I want or need. So that's mm-hmm. a very safe and empowering place for them to be able to say, do this or don't do this, and then allow the team to ask questions. And so I find most people are really eager to tell the team what they want or need. And then that kind of opens the door that then they're more willing to hear and be curious and interested to hear what their other team members want or need too. So you mm-hmm. kind of start working in slowly, like it's a lighter lift in to begin getting some of those boundaries down so people will be more curious.
And it's puts the responsibility back in the onto the team members, because to be able to state what it is that I want and need, I think that's daring for some. And there's always these one or two who like to complain and blame others for not doing what they should be doing. But it's very difficult for them to then take the own responsibility to start with stating what they need.
Yeah, that's so true. And not to keep going on about DISC, because there are other ways to do this too. But since we're there, one of the things that I love about DISC is once you know what your style is, and you can begin to figure out easily by observing people, what at least how they're showing up in that moment, it's up to you if you choose to adapt your style to them. You can't control them and what they do, but you can control what you will do. And if you are willing to adapt your style a little bit for them,
yeah,
you will, you know, chances are good you'll improve the relationship. So it is about, hey, instead of pointing the finger at someone else, what can you do? How can you influence them by changing your behavior? So,
yeah. And even if this is difficult, simply communicating our style. I had a wonderful experience with someone who is in the autistic side. And when he found out, he started to clearly communicating with people he was in a conversation with for the first time. Okay, this is how my brain works. This is how I communicate. Sometimes people have the impression that I do X, although I actually intend to do Y. If this happens, please let me know.
Yeah, wonderful.
Kind of a short manual. And I found this inspiring because you don't have to be autistic for doing that.
Right.
Everyone who has a certain style of communicating and realize that often it might lead to misunderstandings, why not giving people a heads up?
Right, right. Instead of guessing, right? Or we often, I think, treat everyone like we think we would want to be treated, and maybe very different. Yes. And so, yeah, it just creates an awareness of, oh, wow, everyone is different and unique. And it pulls on the emotional intelligence of people too, right? It amps up their emotional intelligence that they can become aware of, okay, this person is different than me. And how can I be a better teammate for them? Like what can I do to make it a little bit easier for us to work together?
Yeah. And it reminds me of something that I recently read that, afterwards, I couldn't unsee it anymore, that we all grew up with the golden rule, treat others in the way that you want to be treated yourself. And this actually no longer applies. It's treat others the way they want to be treated, because they might be different from us.
Yeah, it's the platinum rule, right? Treat platinum others rule. Do unto others as they want to be done unto, I think is how it goes, right? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, love that. And if I understand it correctly, then with a air quotes, broken team, you would rather start with an introspection first. So let's look into us. Let's speak about us so that everyone can share what's going on with them before making it a team thing.
Very often, yes. Typically, I might do it in three steps. And so I might say, depending on how much time we have, like here's another one just to move away from DISC, because I obviously love DISC. We'll talk about something else. A great exercise to do at the beginning is you tell everybody, bring something with you that represents something that's very important to you or that represents one of your values. It can be anything, a photo, a picture, an object, anything. And everyone comes in and shares this one object, and then they share why they brought it. And what happens is, we did this once with an executive team where there was a lot of frustration and low trust, and they didn't really know each other well, and they were just really struggling. And they shared things, some very personal, but they were all informative. You kind of learned about someone. Someone brought like a medal because they'd run a bunch of triathlons and they brought a medal in. So that told us about like what they valued, and they tended to be competitive and, you know, enjoyed having the awards. And someone else shared something very personal about their family, a family member that would impact them at work. And it gave an insight to what that person might be experiencing that gave you more empathy for that person. And then it was just very interesting. So even in a quick exercise like that, people are sharing a picture or something that's meaningful to them, and you're seeing a different side of them than you probably have. And it creates an instance, it's a little bit vulnerable. People get to choose how vulnerable they are, but you start to see this person is not this in this role of vice president of whatever, but this is a human being, and it softens people up.
Yeah. And as you said, you learn so much more about this person. So whether someone is rather competitive or seeks more maybe harmony and warmth of a family.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Yeah. And then it gives them something they can later ask more questions about to get to know. So I might do something like that. And then if I were going to do teamwork with a team, one of my favorite tools to use, and I use the Tuckman model, forming, storming, norming, performing, right? Mm-hmm. And that's the simple older version. And I'll like draw it up on a chart with the curves. And I'll just do a really quick explanation about, you know, teams form and then they storm and then they start to work through the storming and they normalize and start to have their ways of working and know each other well. And then ideally they get up to high performing where they're just, everything's rolling really well. They're exceeding goals. And I talk just briefly, more than I did just now, Miriam, about each of these things, but not long. And then I give everybody either like a dot sticker or a marker, or if we're virtual, they can just do it with an annotation tool. And I'm like, where do you think the team is now? And actually what I do is I'll do like, if forming was one, I'll do one. And then if storming was two, I'll put a 1.5 on the chart. So we'll have one, 1.5, two, 2.53, 3.54. I'll say, write down your number on a sticky note because I don't want them to change it. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have them come up and put their dot or mark the chart, if you will, where they are. And then we just have a really open dialogue. Like, it's not about deciding or making a decision. It's just, this is really interesting. And usually there's some spread on this chart. There's your optimist who has you way up, they're high performing, and there's some people who have you further down or in storming. And we'll go, okay. And then we'll kind of look at clusters and go, all right. So those of you who said, hey, you think you're really high performing, whoever was up here, like, what are you seeing? Why did you say that? Oh, okay, that's interesting. And then we'll kind of work our way down into the clusters, not do every single person, but wherever the clusters are, and just kind of hear the perspective of the team about where they are. It's not, again, it's not about at this point coming to agreement. It's just hearing people. And now they're at a place where they're starting to not just talk about themselves, but they're starting to openly talk about where they see the team. And then I use this opportunity to talk about how storming is a very normal and natural process for every team. And even if they get to high performing, as soon as a new person is hired or someone leaves or there's a change, they're going to storm again. It's just that they might get through the storming process faster if they're working well together. So I talk about normalizing storming for them.
Yeah.
And then we say, so how do you get from storming to norming and then high performing? Well, you work on it. You have conversations. You do team building. And that's what we're here to do today, is to do work to begin moving you closer to either, depending on where they scored themselves, either norming or high performing. So it kind of gets them ready, like, oh, it's okay that we're storming right now. This is just normal. And that's what we're going to do today, is figure out how do we begin to move out of storming. And I feel like it shifts the mindset to more of a growth mindset about, hey, we can do this. And it gets them ready for then whatever exercises we're about to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And I wonder whether it's intentional that you would start zooming into the group that is in the high performance. So kind of the happy group, those who think, oh, we are thriving, we don't even need some team building, to keep the energy up, and then kind of bringing some positive ideas and positive reflections into the room before you look at those who think we are not performing well.
That's a great question. I'm actually thinking, have I done it the other way too? And I may have. I might just instinctually go where I think the group needs to go. And if they feel uncomfortable, I might start one place. Or if it's real heavy towards the bottom, which on the bottom, you can't see a chart because I've got my hands moving. But if they were really down into like storming or in that phase, I might start there if there were a whole lot of dots. I don't know that I have. That's a great point. It kind of depends on maybe what I instinctually where I think they're ready to go to get them there.
Yeah. And maybe even who has put their dot where, because I can also imagine that if the team leader, the manager, the highest person in the room has a better view, then if you start with them, the others might feel judged.
Good point. Probably don't want to start with where, if you know where the leader was, it's probably good to start with others to get them talking. Yeah.
Yeah, because otherwise it's so easy to have a leadership bias and everyone just agreeing or then not wanting to disagree, especially if there's something in the room.
That's not right. Okay. Right. Like if the leader thinks it's going well, I don't want to tell them that it's not. Yeah. So I've done this so many times. And again, I make a point of just whatever they say, they're like, oh yeah, thanks for sharing that. That's interesting. Okay, let's get a different perspective. And I'll use words like that. Who has a different point of view or a different perspective? Let's look here. What did you all see? And so it's very much about just hearing people, and everybody's right because it's their point of view, and everybody's point of view is 100% right.
And yes, I totally agree. And I think there are many teams and individuals who are not there yet in terms of self-awareness or maturity or just a worldview. How much prep work do you do before such a workshop to see how different actually the energies in the space are? Because sometimes it just needs one rotten fish, toxic person, however you want to call them.
Yeah. And it's good to know, right? Because it sets us up as facilitators on how we will approach it. So ideally, in the ideal world, I would do with a team session I would always obviously talk to the leader. You know, you start with the leader and get their perspective, and their perspective is full of bias, as all, you know, as my perspective will be at the team too, right? And so you want to get the leader's perspective. And then ideally, I would do two things. One would be to do a team assessment, where the team is all, you know, looking at the same questions and answering them. And then you have data about how the team sees itself, which is really helpful and kind of helps you kind of see patterns. And then ideally, you also would have a time to do at least a 20 to 30 minute interview with every team member prior to the session. And I love to do that because, well, for a couple of reasons. One is it allows me to build some rapport and trust with them. I'm not some stranger in the room now. And I can really hear each person's point of view or perspective or dig deeper about things to try to understand what's going on in the room, what they want and need. And sometimes people will share something with you like that or expand in a way that just gives me a broader understanding. So to me, but at the same time, I have to be careful when I'm interviewing someone because my bias comes in too, or if I'm listening for something, or if I have a story. I was doing team interviews pretty recently, and I spoke with one person and she had a very strong opinion about one of the other team members and how she felt like this person was, you know, not a good team player and didn't respond well and was checked out and very hard to get in touch with. And she felt like other people had a lot of issues with this particular team member too. It wasn't just her. And then I talked to that team member who she was talking about. So I had to really check myself because I had a story about this guy because of this other person had told me about him. And that was just her story about him. So I had to really kind of check myself and be careful of what I asked or didn't ask so that I wasn't being biased. And of course I was, because you can't not be biased, but I had to really kind of check for that.
Wow. And how did you approach the specific situation where you have an intake team and then there too, there is some tension?
Yeah. So interestingly, he didn't bring up any tension at all. And interestingly, how he showed up for me in that interview was very aloof, like very just kind of, I felt like he was giving me just the the right answers, if you will. It was kind of interesting. So I had a little bit of confirmation bias that he might be a little difficult to work with. As she said, I could see it. And so I was really trying to be careful of my bias and seeing that a little bit too. So what, this is all still kind of in progress right now. And so nothing's been resolved. However, awareness that that's going on, to be able to talk in the team about how are we working together and how are we showing up. And then the potential as well for, sometimes you have to decide if, does this belong, is this best for the team to all work through together? Or is this best done with two individuals or two individuals and a leader outside of the session, you know? And there's a little bit of a judgment call there.
I was about to ask that question. How do you make the decision? I mean, obviously you are a coach as well, so that helps. So you do have the expertise to say, okay, this is something that we have to take outside of the team, because not everyone has to sit around the table while two are solving their issues. When and how would you take that decision? Is it something that you discuss with the team leader or with the participants?
Yes. And so it all depends on who it is, right? Who is the leader, one of the people involved in this? Is it not? What's my relationship with everyone on the team? What's the expectation of me? Did lots of people have the same feedback, or does it show up in the assessment about this person? Or was it just one person's bias and one person's? So it all depends. This one hasn't fully played out yet. There's actually another facilitator. We're working in this one together, and we had the conversation about it went into the report that the team will see. This is a very senior team and it's a very small team. And so it did go into the report, not word for word, but just that this person was perceived as being, I forget the exact words, but difficult to reach and unapproachable. We did use those words and put them in there. And so to bring that out in dialogue, because this is the type of team at the senior level that they need to be able to have these kind of conversations together. So we did put that in there and we haven't had that debrief yet. And evidently we know from talking to the leader that this person, it won't be a surprise to him that he's heard this feedback before. And so it will be an interesting conversation in the room, a difficult one, probably a challenging one. Mm-hmm. And so he's aware of this and this is happening, and it'll be a chance for them to decide, you know, how is the whole team impacted, if at all, and what do they want or need from him, and what does he want or need from them? But this is where I think this is why they hire facilitators or coaches to come in, right? These conversations are awkward and hard. Mm-hmm. And so having an objective person who can come in and help a team work through this and not skate around it, because we can skate around this for years, or we can start to say, this is an issue for you all. What do you all want to do about it? And help them begin to have those conversations and figure it out.
Yeah. And it sounds like a challenge to differentiate from what is about the person and what is about their behavior, because very quickly, especially in small teams, we put labels on other people's foreheads. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's arrogant. Instead of he acts unreachable. And it almost feels like you need a level of trust to have these difficult conversations, because only when you trust that the team members respect you as a person, although they might not agree with certain behaviors. So you do need trust to have this conversation. On the other hand, the trust might not be there yet because they're just seeing this behavior.
Yeah. And then you could also say, because of this behavior, there is no trust, right? So if you look at why people trust, part of it's, do they care? Part of it's, are they competent? Part of it's, are they reliable? Are they authentic? There's a lot of different reasons. And so in this particular case, if this person's continually not making meetings, rescheduling meetings, not doing what he says he's going to do and breaking trust, it's like, what comes first, the chicken or the egg? It's kind of hard to say, but I think in this particular incident, in this one example, the behaviors are getting in the way of this person being trusted by others.
And also respect, right? If someone always reschedules my meetings, I have the impression that this person doesn't respect me.
Yeah.
Well, and that's if a good trust point. And respect are missing, that's a slippery slope.
It is. And if the behavior is allowed to continue to go unchecked and no one's holding anyone accountable or talking about it, chances are it's not just going to go away. It hasn't so far. So it's, yeah, this is when you have to have really difficult conversations, candid, open conversations with the intention of what do we do? What's best for our, you know, all of us here and the team. Yeah. How do we figure this out together?
Yeah. Which brings to mind topics like psychological safety.
Yeah.
So to what extent can we actually speak it out? And if there's one person who is perceived as difficult or acts difficult in the team, how do you address this topic without putting them in a corner and being defensive? Because to be honest, it is about them.
It is. And so depending on how like they're being difficult and how much you know that prior to the session, it could be conversations prior to the session about, you know, expectations going in and how they're going to show up and what you want or need from them or what they want or need from you. I mean, it may be sometimes that that informational interview at the beginning really does help establish some trust. You're not just some facilitator coming in who's on the side of the leader. You know, if this person is has any bias against that, it kind of can level the playing field a little bit, I think, to have these conversations and find out what their concerns are, what's important to them. I was working recently with another facilitator coach, just helping her think through a design of a session she's doing, because it's a tough one. It's a really big group. It's more of a group than a team. And I'll be really high level generic here. But there's one player that's perceived as being very hostile and aggressive and dominating. And that's one of the reasons she was hired to come in and lead the session, because the leader was unable to manage that. And then this person openly expressed a lot of concerns about the session. And this is just going to be a touchy-feely session. And this is, we're going to all stand around and sing Kumbaya. And what's the point? And was really resistant to the facilitator. And she just managed it like a pro. Like she listened, she heard, she validated, she confirmed what she would do or not do. And then she had some ground rules around, you know, going into that session. And then when he went around and would say anything really like blatantly, like he seemed to be the type, this is again my story of him from what I heard, is he kind of enjoyed throwing the wrench into the mix to see what would happen. Like he kind of seemed to enjoy that. She would just really like hear him, not emotionally react, and redirect it really quickly. Like, so she managed it and he seemed to respect that. It's almost like he wanted to play with her to see if he could knock her off her game, if you will. Like it was almost, that's how it felt.
Like her. Very childlike behavior, actually, to catch attention and see how far they can push the boundaries.
Yes. So she did a really good job of, you know, it, because she went in really prepared for how to do this, like anticipating, thinking through how she would, and just held her space and held up the mirror sometimes to him and then redirected and worked through it. So that's kind of an extreme example. I mean, I find fortunately it's rare that I have someone that just really wants to be disruptive. Mm-hmm. I find it's more likely that there's somebody on the team that really just, maybe they're very different in that they see it differently, or they think about whatever the team, like they feel in some ways like they're the outsider because they just see or think or do things so differently than other people on the team. And they feel like there's resistance to them. And there probably is resistance to them because they're wanting to do it differently. Mm-hmm. And figuring out how do we help them feel heard and be sure they are heard and understood, and yet not let that completely take over our meeting and sidetrack us. It's a delicate dance, this facilitation that we're in.
Especially because those that you just described, they are different and they have the potential to bring so much to the team just by being different. And still now everyone screams for more diversity and we want diverse teams. And very rarely we speak about the difficulty to communicate with people who are different than us. Of course, we love to communicate to those who share our opinions, who are just similar to what we are used to. And dealing with different personalities is difficult.
It is. And then when it's the leader, it's even tougher, right? And I can think of a situation where the leader was the one really struggling and the team was struggling with the leader, and the leader knew it, but wasn't sure how to work around it. A little bit of lack of awareness. Her style was very blunt and direct, and she had been promoted from within. So anytime someone's promoted from within, and then there's a team member who was competing, it's always, well, I will say always, but very often there's some awkward tension that's left. Like if you and I are going for the same job and you get promoted and now I report to you and you used to be my peer, there's some tension there, right?
Yeah, for good reasons.
Yes, yes, yes. And so it was kind of one of those situations. And then this leader was just very direct and blunt and sometimes didn't think before she spoke and was overly blunt, like didn't have a lot of tact. And so it was a very small group, but because of that, there was a lot of eroded trust. And so we did an assessment, even though it was a really small group, we did the assessment. So we had all the kind of data to talk about, to bring up the conversations, and I did the interviews. And then I found in that session, I think at one point someone said, this feels like therapy, which is never what I'm going for. But like sometimes these two people, the leader would be trying to say what she meant. And I could think at least what I think she meant to say, but it would come across just really direct and harsh. And the team member would kind of hold back and shut down because it's her leader. Like you could tell it would hurt her feelings or she would shut down. So I found myself doing a lot of, can I tell you what I think I heard her say? Mm-hmm. What I think I heard her say was, and like, I would summarize it in a different way and they would, you know, agree or disagree with me. And it was almost like I became an
translator
role to help them translate and see. And it helped. Like it helped them. Like by the end, they got where they could at least have a better understanding or have more empathy for, I think, each other's point of view. Yeah. It was a start. It was a start to getting better.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that. Because I think especially in those situations where the team leader is perceived as difficult or toxic by the team, it gets really difficult also for the team members to build trust to each other. So there's really it does have an impact. And then how to deal with that, I think, as a team and also as a leader.
I think this is too an example of where coaching is really helpful. Mm-hmm. So if it's the leader, especially if the leader is the one that's hired me, I feel like it's very appropriate and easier for me if it's the leader to then pull them aside or debrief with them later or give them points, you know, give them some coaching around what I've seen or noticed or how they're showing up. They need some of that. I've never met a leader who wanted to do a bad job or wanted to be. And often I think leaders are so overwhelmed and they're doing their very best and they don't know how to get out of their own way. And this is where an observation and maybe some coaching can really help them.
Yeah, especially in the situation that you described where internally one gets promoted, the other one not. And assuming that we all have imposter syndrome to some degree, that we have the impression that the world thinks we are smarter than we actually are. If then the new leader is insecure, uncertain, and believes, oh, maybe the other person actually deserved it better. I think it's very human to try to cover up our insecurities. Yeah. And then what shows is to be overly directive or to be defensive or to be the commander instead of maybe being warm and open and transparent. Say, okay, listen, guys, we all wanted this job. Now I have it. How can we deal with it?
Yes, yes. You're right. And they may not have the awareness that they're doing that, mm-hmm. or they may not have the skills or the know-how to do that. And yeah, coaching and training can be really helpful here for a leader to transition like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good compliments to just a team leading workshop, team building workshop, air quotes. And you mentioned a couple of times the assessment. And it sounds as if you have standard assessment questions that you would send to the team. Can you give maybe an example?
Sure. So I actually have a model called the Better Teams model. We've been talking about pieces of that model, connection, alignment, or pieces of that trust, mm-hmm. or all pieces of that. And then there's an assessment that I use that relates to that model. And so there's questions for each of those areas. And a team can assess themselves and figure out how well are they doing. And I use that data as a starting point to a conversation. So the report doesn't say, Miriam, your team is good at this or bad at this. It just gives you your scores and your comments. And then through the facilitated process, it's let's talk through. What are you seeing? Let's go through this. What does the team think they're doing really well? What do you want to celebrate? What's working? What do you want to build on? And then we get into, okay, what are the greatest opportunities? And it may or may not be where they scored the lowest, by the way. They get to decide, like, we think of all of the, there's a conversation here, obviously. There's a facilitated process to help them really kind of think it through. But ultimately, the team narrows down and chooses one or two or three things that they really want to work on to build what I would call a happy and high-performing team. Mm. And then they begin to action, figure out what are the action steps or next steps to do that.
Yeah. And since you just said happy, is there a limitation to happiness? What I hear and read is there are different camps. There are those who say, oh, if we can all be like a big family, that's fantastic. And we'll work great together. And others say, well, a team is a team. It's not your family. And there are limits to that because then it creates other sorts of tensions if you're too happy or if you're thriving for happiness. What's your opinion?
So I think happiness is vital. Vital. If you have a team that's working really well together, as far as they're meeting their goals or all doing what they said, maybe they're even exceeding their goals, but they aren't happy, then they're either going to do the quiet quitting thing we were talking about earlier, or they're going to leave and go somewhere else, or they're going to become that disgruntled, frustrated person who becomes toxic. So, but to me, happiness, what happiness represents, and this is part of that model, there are three things we need to be happy. We need to feel connected to people. And that means different things, right? Some people really want to know all about you as a human being, and other people just really want to know about your work. So, but we need to feel connected. We need to feel engaged. Like, we like what we do. We enjoy our work. We're playing in our strengths and sweet spots. And we also need to feel fulfilled to be happy. Mm-hmm. Like, what we're doing here is really making a difference in some way in the world. And the other part of fulfillment is I'm growing. I feel like I'm growing and I'm evolving. So I think, to me, happiness, now the family part, that's interesting. I've read that too recently. Like, that maybe is a whole different discussion. Are we a family or are we a team? But I think happiness is critical because that's how you retain people. And that's where you're getting people that are at their best too, because they're loving what they're doing. They're getting into the flow state and they want to be there. They want to be collaborating.
Yeah. Thank you. This makes sense. This makes absolute sense. And one thought that I parked earlier is that when you spoke about trust and how people build trust, some is through connection, some is through sharing, is there something like a personality model for how do you build trust? Because I have the impression that's something very personal. Some test, and maybe it's about telling something that is not repeated. Others need to be invited to someone's house. I don't know.
Great question. So there are lots of ways that we have trust or build trust. And for me in the teams, I go back to three things. Vulnerability is one of them, Miriam. You just mentioned that. So if I'm willing to be vulnerable and tell you, I don't know, I'm not sure, I need help, and I can feel safe to do that and that it's not going to hurt me or you're going to judge me or it's going to hurt my career to not know, that's a way to build trust. And so even some of the examples of even sharing what you want or don't want with a DISC style or bringing that item that is something that you value, people get to choose how vulnerable they are. And yet if they're even a little bit vulnerable, and if you're vulnerable with me, I will feel safer being vulnerable back, right? Yeah. So that's one way. I think another part of trust is being candid with each other and feeling like people are being honest and transparent and real and telling you their truth or disagreeing if they disagree, doing it in a respectful way, obviously, but being able to say, hey, I have a different point of view, or I think this is the wrong way to do it, or I need you to do something differently. Like, having those candid conversations, and that can be comfortness, but can also be skill building. Sometimes people don't need some training here on how to have a candid conversation or a courageous conversation, how to do that in a respectful way.
So true. And yeah, you just remind me also to have a look at our private relationships. The biggest, most trusting relationships I have built with friends and partners is by having these difficult conversations and being candid.
Yeah. And when you can work through a difficult conversation, like, you maybe you have a real big issue with someone, but you're both willing to talk about it, work through it, see the other person's point of view, and just resolve it. You might have been from where you almost didn't like someone to now you really trust them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I've had that experience too, where you work through something and because you had an issue with someone and vice versa, you actually trust them way more quickly.
Yeah, because then you know that whatever happens, you can count that they will be candid also in the future.
Yeah.
I remember I've spoken to friends and even partners saying that I've been avoiding you and here is the reason. Can we talk about that? This is what I feel. And when they are open to just listen and to find a solution and explain where they are coming from and me to understand where they are coming from and explain where I'm coming from. Yeah, they're very mature relationships by now.
Yes, yes. Mm. And so as facilitators, I think we can really encourage these kind of dialogues to take place, right? Where sometimes people don't know how, or they don't have the time, or they don't make the time, I should say. If we're with them in a session and we hear something bubbling and we can tell there's something more there and yet the team isn't comfortable going there, this is where we can ask those questions and draw that out and have the uncomfortable conversation and help them work through it.
Yeah.
And hear and understand each other. And this is where facilitation is so powerful, I think.
Yeah. What remains your number one facilitation challenge?
Time. Time. I always think I can do more than I can in an agenda or just time. Like I always want more time. I always think, oh, we needed more time, or I want more time. And I find now too, even with team sessions, they're like, we'll give you half a day. Can we give you 2 hours? Can we give you an hour? Like an hour? You want to give me an hour? I want 2 days. So to do this deeper work, to have these really important conversations that are significant and not superficial, we need time. And so that to me is where I always struggle.
Yeah. It's so funny. So, and it's interesting to hear that someone who already came to the conclusion that they want to work with the team, that there is an issue, then to believe that you can do it in an hour.
Yeah. Yeah. It's amazing how often I get an hour or 2 hours. And I'm always, well, we could do that if we could just have an extra hour or two. You know, I'm always trying to negotiate for every little, even an extra 30 minutes can make an impact. Or you just have to kind of negotiate with what's realistic. What can we really do in this amount of time? But I find that to be a challenge right now. Everybody wants it quick, short. Yeah.
Yeah. And still, if you need time to arrive, to open up, to build trust, to do the work and then to close.
Yeah. And to make sure you're walking away. Yeah. Clear on who's doing what next. All of that. Yeah. It all takes time. So that's, do you find that too? Are you finding time to be a challenge or people wanting shorter sessions?
Yes. Needing more time, especially more time for the participants to communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. I think this is something that I also underestimated as a facilitator because we don't feel where they're going in the breakouts, for instance, or when they have their small group conversations. And there are things you cannot discuss in 10 minutes. And just because the 10 minutes seem endless to me on the other side.
I totally relate to that, right? Right. We're just sitting there waiting, especially if it's virtual and we can't walk around and kind of peek in and listen. It feels like a long time. But when you're in those rooms, they come back and they go, oh, we needed more time. That was too short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially if they know each other and they have stuff to work through. And I think it's difficult to assess. And also, especially online, there is this moment that if you give them too much time and they actually don't have anything to talk about, then they will zone out and then you have this awkward silence and then we'll go, let me just check my emails. Oh yeah, I also have work to do. And then this actually creates more distance than connection after all.
I agree. I think I tend to err on the side of a little, not quite enough time, then too much time where they get bored or distracted. I think you're right. And to me, I don't know if you do this, but like in Zoom, I use Zoom mostly. And so I set mine for a 30-second warning, you know, so they have, when it closes, they have just 30 seconds, not a minute, and then they come back. And what's interesting to me is when people come back early, you know, before they had to, especially if a lot of people do. Sometimes there's that one group that just struggled and they just didn't get into the conversation as much. But if a lot of people come back early, I'm like, okay, that was too much time.
Yes.
And then when nobody comes back until the end and they're all forced back in the room, you're like, okay. So they were obviously all still really engaged in the conversation. So that's just one little subtle way. And I check in a lot. I'll go, how was the time? Did you have, because it is kind of each group is a little different with how much time they need. And you have to kind of, it is a delicate balance there.
Totally. Totally. And now I like the option with Zoom now that you can see the activity in the room. So you don't hear their words, but you see who's speaking and how much.
I did not know this, Miriam.
Yeah, you can actually check a box in the back end. And then as a participant, you get the sign that the facilitator can track your activity. So you have the microphone and you see if someone shares the screen or if someone has a camera or microphone off.
Oh my gosh, this is new to me. I'm excited. Okay, I'll have to check it out.
So that's really nice. And then if they, what you mentioned, if they come back to immediately or at the very last minute, it's also a sign for us as facilitators, I think, to how to tune into this energy. Because if they were talking until the last second, they're mentally still in this conversation. So you cannot just, okay, so now let's do the next thing. They might need just another moment to digest what just happened.
That's a really great point. And they say sometimes, I was mid-sentence, or they'll even still be talking to their partner as they're coming back into the room and you get a taste of what they were saying. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting to figure all that out. Yeah, it is easier. That's one, as much as I love virtual sessions, and I think in some ways they can be better. That's one element that I do miss in a room. You can kind of walk around and do a little bit of gentle eavesdropping and you can see more how people are doing. Do they need more? Or you can ask easier without, you know, jumping into the Zoom room and going, do you need more time? Which is so disruptive, I feel like. Yeah.
On the other hand, that's then where the time just evaporates. Right? Because then you don't want to interact. It really depends on your personality and how easy you are with your presence. Like, oh, you do need some more time. And then suddenly,
right,
time is up. Yeah. What makes a workshop fail?
That's a great question. I think if we do our jobs really well, we won't ever have a complete fail, right? Because even when things aren't going like we hoped, then we can use that as, wow, what just happened here? You know, so-and-so just stormed out of the room, or so-and-so cried, or, you know, we got to a stalemate. So to me, like, we could always use even things that don't go like we hope they will in our agendas as an opportunity. I guess if there was something that would keep it from just what would really be an ultimate fail to me, it would be that if the majority of the people, or even a significant number of people in the room, were just checked out and unwilling to have the conversation, unwilling to be truthful, then it would be really hard on the end to, you know, get where you needed to get.
Yes, interesting situation. And I wonder whether this happens if there's a lack of connection and trust to the facilitator, even more than between the group.
Maybe. And I have to be honest, I've never had that happen. I mean, I've ever had one person that was, yeah, sure, but I've never had that. And I have gone into situations that were highly tense. And that's why they had me coming in. And this is where those, again, having that 20-minute call, 30-minute call ahead of time really helped for them to see, I'm not on anyone's side here. I'm really wanting to hear your perspective. Having ground rules and doing some sort of exercise that creates a little bit of safe vulnerability at the beginning. And then having people start to go, okay, this is safe. Mm. And no one's wrong here. No one's getting put on the spot here. And all points of view are welcome here. I feel like I've been able to get really tough groups to start to, like, deep breathe and slot, not literally, but, you know, take a breath and start to be more open and have more real conversations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all about the prep work.
A lot of it is. Yeah. A lot of it is. And then setting the stage, I think, at the beginning too, for what it is and what it isn't. And yeah. And then just really listening and being real and respectful of everyone, even the person, like, if there is that really difficult person in the room, like, even like managing that in a very respectful, but not, I hate to say authoritative, but sometimes with someone like that, you have to be a little bit, you know,
yeah,
I've got this. And you can do that in a very respectful way.
Yeah, because the worst is when we get triggered and this difficult person is, getting our inner child out.
Yeah.
Because they're speaking to us in a certain way or not respecting us. And then we start doubting. But I think if we're grounded as facilitators, we can be directive and respectful.
Yeah, right. Or throw it back to them. Like, really tell us more about what you're wanting or needing. And like not be afraid to go there with them, which they might be surprised by. But fortunately, I feel like those are rare, at least for me. Maybe I've been lucky. Those are rare. It's rare to get someone who just really is trying to antagonize.
And I think I agree with what you said before. Actually, everyone wants to do a good job and be a good person. And if they're acting in a way that is perceived as difficult, there's usually a reason for that.
Yeah. They often feel unheard, I think, and or just don't have a better skill set to be able to express themselves in a way that's more likely to be heard. Yeah.
Yeah.
Keeps it interesting though, right? This is what makes it kind of fun for me in a way. You never quite know what's going to happen or how it's going to go or what might trigger someone, or, you know, sometimes there's surprises that happen.
Yeah. And funny enough, I think we often forget that it's actually, we do need the friction is to get new ideas, to find new solutions, to even be engaged and entertained and not bored. We do have different roles in teams, and if they're missing.
Yeah, you're right. Right.
Innovation.
So, yeah, we can honor that. We can know, like, oh, wow, this is great. Like, I mean, that might be something with a team that seems to be low trust and hesitant to have candid conversations. Mm-hmm. Like, as the facilitator to say, hey, you just look, are you observing what I am right now? I'm really seeing you all share some very different points of view, very respectfully. And yet you have really different points of view and you're all talking and hearing and, you know, so even like pointing out, like stopping and observing or asking them what they're observing, you can use that as a moment too for them to recognize what they're doing well and encourage that type of behavior and make it safe, like normalize. It's okay that we all want to do it differently. It's okay that we have different priorities.
Yeah. And isn't it funny that even amongst adults, the power of a candid compliment and reassurance works?
Yeah.
To normalize, to giving them the impression that it's okay, that they're doing well, that they're good people, that they're working hard.
Yeah, I think so. You're right. I think so. Because we all have some of those basic needs, right? That we want to feel like we matter and we're doing well. And yeah, I think that's true. It's as long as it's genuine. And I think it's important, especially with a team who's struggling or an individual who's struggling, to be really authentic and candid, even if they're just doing it a little bit, like knowing that it's so hard for them and then acknowledging them for that just reinforces that they're on the right track.
Yeah. Which makes me now think of something different, but maybe related. So in the family constellations, I'm not an expert in family constellations, far away, but from what I understand is that in families, you have different roles that someone grows into, and then it's very difficult to put this role apart or to put it aside, not apart, aside. Do you observe the same with teams, that every team has maybe certain roles to distribute, and then if there's a free role, someone grows into it or gets pushed into it, and this might lead to friction?
And when you say roles, do you mean here, I think you mean not like literally a role or a job, but you mean more of a way of being, like you're the contrarian, or
exactly. Yeah.
You're the, like, is that what you mean? You're the good deep person or whatever it might be. It's an interesting question, Miriam. I mean, I imagine, I'm just going to riff here with you because I haven't really thought this one through, but on some level, that's probably very true. Like, we tend to look for patterns, I think, in other people, because that gives us a sense of security and safety, right? When we know what to expect from each other. And if I know that one person on the team is, you know, really good at taking care of the details, and I think that can be true, that we could do that and unconsciously even, box someone in to a role. So yeah, that would be interesting. It would be interesting to talk about too, like with a team, what are the, if you felt like that was happening, what are the strengths? What is everyone bringing to the team? And what is, you know, how do they show up? I mean, it could be an interesting conversation, especially if people were feeling boxed into something and they didn't like what they were getting boxed in for.
Yeah. And then always seeing the silver lining even of these stereotypes. So what can we learn from the super detailed persona?
Yeah. Yeah.
What are they from the endless nagger?
Yeah. Yeah. Or the contrarian, right? Yeah. Oh, they always find what's wrong. And thank goodness, you know what that makes me think of? Have you ever heard of the De Bono's six thinking hats?
Yes.
It kind of reminds me of that. Like that can be a fun exercise to do, you know, and especially if you had one person who tends to be the contrarian, you know, they always find what's wrong. And then because they do that, the minute they open their mouth to tell you, everybody's like, oh, here they go again. They always find what's wrong, right? But it would be interesting to talk about maybe they do that though, because the team is so gung-ho and they're all running full steam ahead and they're missing things because they're just excited or they're all accommodating to each other and they're like, Yeah, that's great. And so they feel like they need the contrarian, but maybe then you say, okay, so do we want to take turns? It's a helpful role so that I'm making this up so that Bob doesn't always have to feel like he has to be the contrarian. What if we rotated that role and different ones of us play that? If that was a challenge for the team, that could be an interesting way to get them to think about roles and then sometimes shifting or changing or sharing the responsibility for the different.
And seeing the benefits of it. Oh, today I can be Bob.
Yeah. And that's good, right? Because Bob slows us down and makes sure we're not missing something.
Yeah.
We've really thought it through and we're not just being flighty and jumping on something.
And I can perfectly see that in a team where everyone is extroverted, super excited about whatever and running to get stuff done, that someone who's more sensitive to that is like, oh, I need to save them. I need to tell them to take care of the details.
Yeah.
And then it's perceived as a troublemaker.
Mm. Right. I was actually working with a team recently and they talked a lot about harmony and how they all get along and you know, where are areas of tension? We really don't have any tension. And how can a team not have any tension, right? And so is it just suppressed or what is it? And it was a very team where everyone was accommodating, a lot of accommodating. And the good thing about that was they really got along well. They really liked each other. They felt supported by each other. There were some really good things, but any strength overplayed becomes a weakness. So it was really good to a point. And then it got to be to a point where though they weren't always holding each other accountable, or if you were doing something and I didn't think it was a good idea, I might go, well, Miriam, have you thought about this? And if you go, yeah, but it's okay, I would drop it. Whereas it might've been better if I pushed that or said, well, I really think that more. So it was kind of an interesting thing with this team where they needed a contrarian, like they needed permission, if you will, to check each other, hold each other accountable, see it from a different lens. Because it was out of their comfort zone. Like no one on the team was like that.
Interesting. Yeah, I can see the danger. And then I can see how if someone comes up, they also haven't trained the muscle to have difficult conversations with each other.
Yeah, they like the peace, right? And it goes back to disc styles too, right? Some styles just like, I can be that way. I like the peace. I have to really feel strongly to really argue my point, right? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, but if we become aware of that, that as a team, we're all that way. And because of that, we're really not going to be our best because we're not going to challenge each other. How do we build that muscle to be able to challenge each other more? Yeah. Or a team might be the exact opposite. Like there's some teams where everyone's challenging everybody about everything. And so it's just frustrating and they don't get anywhere. And so they might need to self-regulate and pick and choose. And so every team is so different.
Mm, yeah. And I like the idea with the thinking hats.
Yeah. Yeah.
Changing the roles, rotating the roles in the team.
Absolutely. Like to me, anything we can do to help teams like stand back and look at themselves and go, huh, what are we doing well? And how do we, you know, what do we need to do to work more effectively together? Again, I always go back to be both happy and high performing. What do we need to do more of? And I mean, there's so many different ways we can help a team assess themselves.
Yeah.
And that could be a fun one to use as a description of roles. And do we have all of these? Do we use all of these? Do we want to be intentional about using these different hats and things like that?
Mm. Mm. My brain is firing.
Yeah.
All different sorts of activities now.
Nice. It's fun to kind of think it through and hear other people and what they do and get ideas. And yeah, it's fun to have a lot of different tools to be able to pull out. And because, you know, some teams will respond to one and not to another. Some want the lighter, fun stuff. Some are like, no, let's get serious. And so you've got to have a variety, I think, as a facilitator of techniques and tools and ways of doing things so you can pivot and be ready to meet that team with where they need you to be.
Yeah. And even if it's the Trojan horse, like where the team has the impression that they're engaging in this fun bits, superficial, whereas what's going on underneath, and they are not aware of what's going on, and then only learn during the debrief.
Yes.
Nice. We've been talking for over an hour.
That went by fast, Miriam.
Is there anything that you wanted to share with the audience that we didn't get the chance to speak about yet?
Oh, let me think. I think it's just been fun thinking about trust and how to build it, how it's so important. And I think we obviously want teams to trust each other. I think they also really need to trust us as the facilitator. And there are things we can do before the session even begins, at the beginning, and then all the way through to work to earn their trust so that they will trust the process and then ultimately, hopefully, achieve whatever goals they had of those sessions. So I think it's a big responsibility on us to be trustworthy and do things to earn trust of our participants in our sessions.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think you mentioned a few forms of building that trust by having the conversations up front, having the guiding principles or rules at the beginning, sharing that you're not there to judge or you don't take any position.
Yeah. And asking people to be candid, encouraging them to share different points of view and respect different points of view, all of that. Yeah. And I've got just tons of team exercises, by the way. I blog, Miriam. I think you probably know that, but I blog and I've got tons of free team building exercises at better-teams.com. Some are light, some are more serious, but all are designed to get people sharing and getting to know each other. And so there's a lot of great resources on my website too for people interested in that.
Awesome. I put everything in the show notes.
Thank you.
And how to download your materials, but also how to join your training in Better Teams.
Oh, excellent. Right? Okay.
Yes.
I do. I have a team consultant academy where I teach all about the Better Teams model and assessment and then DISC and agenda models. It's all of that. It's for people who really love to do team building and want to use the Better Teams model. Thank you for that.
Of course. Yeah. Thank you for sharing. Wonderful conversation. So many golden nuggets.
I've been looking forward to doing this with you. So thank you for the opportunity. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for staying tuned and for listening to the show. I know how busy you are, and I appreciate that you're sharing your two most valuable resources with me and my guest, your time and your attention. If you're looking for more conversation with other facilitators and for a community of practice, why don't you join Never Done Before, the community that I have built and many of my podcast guests are already members. Visit neverdonebefore.org and I wish to see you there.